march of time. Time, the weekly news magazine, takes you to the news fronts of the world.
China.
How free Japanese are fighting against their homeland.
Germany.
The story behind the photographs of one of the war's strangest episodes.
Washington.
Is 60 million jobs an empty slogan or a real post-war possibility?
Detroit.
Who is to blame for lagging war production, labor or management? Stand by for the March of Time.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Westbrook Van Forest speaking for the editors of Time magazine. This week, while American forces were hacking a continent-wide boulevard into Germany, U.S. Army authorities announced a lesser but also important victory in the back streets of Paris. They are smashing the black market that feeds vital U.S. military supplies into the French black market. Worst offenders are among several gangs of U.S. Army deserters. These men face death as punishment, not for stealing, but for desertion. And several dozen have already been executed in France. Some have been killed resisting arrest. Among the latter were members of the Walter Gang, who operated in Paris. This week's issue of Life, sister magazine to Time, publishes a report on the breakup of the Walter Gang by Life photographer David Sherman, who made step-by-step photographs as the Army tracked down the gang. This is how David Sherman tells the story in photographs and facts.
The case of the Walter Gang began in Paris when an American officer found some Army trucks in an out-of-the-way garage. Some French civilians asked him, "When does the sale of gas begin?" He became suspicious and promptly telephoned the Army's Criminal Investigation Division. I accompanied the two agents they sent to the garage to investigate further. The garage was located at the far end of a narrow side street.
How do you like that, Joe? Three big 6x6 trucks in good shape.
And loaded with gasoline cans, full ones.
They must have been here before. Look at those empty cans in the corner.
Yeah. Hey, here's a guy. Maybe he knows something about this. Monsieur! Monsieur!
Eh? Oh, oui, monsieur le capitaine.
Do you know anything about these trucks?
Well, monsieur, I'm the agent for the owner of the buildings in this little street. Over a week ago, an officer came here and requisitioned this garage.
A phony officer, sure as anything. Hmm. Have you got a requisition receipt?
Mais non, monsieur le capitaine. But I often saw a civilian.
Civilian?
Oui, monsieur. A Frenchman in a black automobile talking to the American soldiers who were here. They called him Monsieur Jean.
Guards were left in the little street, and in a few hours they caught an American soldier named Herman on his way to the garage. He led the police to the Hotel de Plaisance, where another member of the gang, Davis, was arrested with his French girl companion. Herman and Davis broke down quickly under questioning and revealed that the gang leaders were living in a shady little hotel, the Familia. I went along with the raiding party.
We got the front door covered, Joe?
Yeah.
There are lights in the kitchen. We work here from the back.
Okay.
Here we go.
All right, men. Come out quietly. We've got you surrounded.
They're firing at us.
Let them have it. Two guys jumping from a window. There's one down. The other got away.
Yeah, here comes another.
Close in on him.
The last man, he was identified later as Walter, came out with a .45 in each hand and wounded two MPs in our raiding party. A few minutes later, I took a picture of his body face down in the corridor outside the kitchen. To break up the gang entirely, the CID realized that Monsieur Jean, the mysterious French civilian in the black automobile, had to be caught. He was the one who had been buying the gas from the deserters and selling it to black market outlet. This brought in a certain Paris detective named Marius Prot, who always refers to himself in conversation as Marius. He started to work on the case and soon learned where Monsieur Jean had fled to. He followed in another car for over 125 miles, caught him, and brought him back to Paris.
So, Monsieur Jean, Marius knows you now.
Well, monsieur.
Your real name is Oudard, and you have served a 10-year sentence at hard labor for murder. And now you have been buying American Army gasoline from the Walter Gang.
I deny it. I accuse you of false arrest.
Marius is not impressed, Monsieur Jean. Here in prison, we have two men who will identify you. Their names are Herman and Davis. Now do you accuse me of false arrest?
While the Walter gang has now been liquidated, other gangs will be operating to some extent as long as goods are scarce in France and American army deserters are on the loose. But these instances of criminality among American soldiers need not disturb the home folks unduly. There are only some 2,500 real deserters out of the millions of American soldiers in Europe. This is the smallest percentage of deserters at any moment in the entire history of our army.
This week, after 2 months of debate, committees of the National Senate and House of Representatives are in conference over bills to draft war workers. These bills are not the strong manpower draft requested by President Roosevelt earlier this year. For high in many a congressman's mind, as in many a citizen's too, is this question.
Are we really short of war workers, or are there other reasons for retarded war production?
In Detroit, top arsenal city of the U.S. and scene of a recent outbreak of strikes, labor believes there are other reasons. So does management. Tonight, the March of Time brings you representatives of the two great conflicting groups of Detroit to give you a straight-from-the-shoulder report of their mutual grievances. For labor, you will hear Victor Reuther, Assistant Director of the War Policy Division of the United Automobile Workers of America. Mr. Reuther will speak to you from Detroit. Come in, Detroit. Go ahead, Victor Reuther.
Detroit's 500,000 war workers have been producing a major share of United Nations armaments for more than 3 years. And now along comes the Automobile Manufacturers Association and tells the Meade Committee that Detroit labor is not doing its part. The truth is that bungling and faulty scheduling by management and the procurement agencies are the real impediments to greater war production. The union pointed out to the Meade Committee that the General Motors Chevrolet Forge plant, the largest of its kind in the nation, is working at only 60% of capacity, despite the dire need for shell forgings. At the steel hammer plant at Dodge Forge, there is unused capacity capable of turning out 20,500 75-millimeter shells a day. At the Detroit Fisher 37 plant, which produces stampings for bombers, there was a 40% layoff during the last 3 weeks in February. At the Ford foundry, the working force since January 1944 has been slashed from 14,400 to 10,200. In addition, managements in their haste to get the jump on profitable piece production have taken skilled men off war jobs and put them to work designing stoves, bicycles, kiddie cars, and scooters. To correct some of these things, the union proposed transfers for skilled workers without loss of their seniority. We proposed giving war jobs to the thousands of unemployed women and Negro workers. We urged institution of a genuine checkup of labor utilization in the war plants. We proposed correction of substandard wage conditions to attract workers to foundries and called for termination of labor hoarding by management. Detroit war production record is unequal. However, labor knows this record can and must be improved. We gave the Meade Committee concrete illustrations of war production deficiencies, and we propose concrete remedies. Sincere consideration of labor's constructive proposals, rather than hysterical mudslinging against labor, will give our fighting men all the weapons for final victory.
Thank you, Victor Reuther. And now the March of Time takes you to Washington to hear Detroit's management side of the debate from George Romney, Managing Director of the Automotive Council for War Production. Come in, Washington. Go ahead, George Romney.
All loyal Americans want the war won quickly. Automotive workers are no exception. Most of them desire to do more work and produce more weapons. But this desire is being thwarted by an unrestrained minority of workers, stewards, and union representatives. CIO's political, economic, and social power now exceeds that of any private organization in our country's history. Abuse of this power has reduced automotive industry production efficiency by from 25 to 50%. There were many more strikes and stoppages in 1944 than during the year of the disgraceful sit-down strikes. And few 1944 strikes involved wages, hours, or working conditions, the legitimate collective bargaining objectives. Most strikes are now called to prevent management from disciplining loafers, establishing work standards, and discharging habitual violators of shop rules. Unions have even pegged and controlled the output of individual workers. Further, CIO seeks to prevent management from acting without union approval. Diminishing automotive productivity is the fruit of seed sown by CIO in the soil of an outdated national labor policy. Under it, even in war, unions have been exempt from laws with which all other Americans must comply. We urge an immediate end to these special union privileges. Adopt promptly a strengthened national labor policy to establish a foundation for a cooperative management labor relationship. Decentralize CIO power, lest, through gaining their major objective of management participation in all companies in basic industries, they create interlocking union management monopolies to fix prices, divide production and markets, and eliminate competition. Otherwise, the workers' right to organize, America's ability to produce, and individual freedom will be lost.
Thank you, George Romney and Victor Reuther, for your debate on labor management differences in Detroit. Differences that must be ironed out to get U.S. war production up where it belongs. Time marches on. Five weeks from now, at least 44 nations will meet in San Francisco to discuss and act on plans for world organization. The plans are popularly known as the Dumbarton Oaks Proposals, drawn in a preliminary meeting last fall at a famed estate in Washington, D.C. called Dumbarton Oaks. For several weeks, the U.S. State Department has been sending its top men out before the country by press, radio, and motion pictures in an unprecedented effort to educate every U.S. man, woman, and adolescent to the importance and meaning of Dumbarton Oaks. A few days ago, seven members of the League of Women Voters of Chattanooga, Tennessee, decided to test public understanding of Dumbarton Oaks, went into the streets of their city, and asked this question of 98 individuals.
What do you think of Dumbarton Oaks?
Answered a lawyer.
If we take part in war, we should take part in peace.
Answered a young girl.
Dumbarton Oaks? Oh, I don't know. We're strangers in town.
A minister.
There never will be a better plan.
Replied a middle-aged woman.
Well, I live in Georgia, so I don't know.
Answered a stenographer.
I don't eat anything but shredded wheat.
Declared an army captain.
I think Dumbarton Oaks is a pretty good thing.
A schoolgirl.
Who?
Said another man.
It's the bunk. The trouble is Russia.
Totting up, Chattanooga's League of Women Voters found that of the 98 persons they had queried about Dumbarton Oaks, two were against, two were neutral, 44 in favor, and 50 never heard of it. In Chattanooga, the State Department's job seemed only half done. But at the same time, the state of New Hampshire, rock-ribbed and conservative, gladdened the State Department. In 225 town meetings held last week, New Hampshire men and women plumped hard for international cooperation via Dumbarton Oaks. Said one voter,
"We're not so narrow anymore. We've changed our minds about a lot of things since the war started."
However, lest the State Department consider its job fully done in New Hampshire, said a grocer in Boscawen,
"I don't think there are many people who do know what it's all about. But I figure 'twon't do any harm."
In 5 weeks, the Dumbarton Oaks proposals will be debated by the nations of the world at San Francisco. The future security of every U.S. man, woman, and child for many a generation may well be at stake. Therefore, tonight, the lesson to the U.S. State Department from Chattanooga and New Hampshire seems pointed. Talk faster, clearer, and louder. Time marches on. This week, many a businessman turned the pages of Time may well have stopped to ponder a report about Russia. For in its new international department, Time says that
the Russians want to borrow $7 billion U.S. dollars to buy machinery and materials from us, things they need to rebuild Russia after the war.
Yes, day by day, as this war races toward its climax, Russia's plans for the future take on a new and very personal importance for every American businessman and worker. And so this week, to bring to the more than a million American families who read Time an even better understanding of Russia, not only as a military ally, but as a great post-war customer of the United States, Time has set up a permanent news bureau in Moscow. To head this new editorial office, Time has flown one of its most knowledgeable reporters to Moscow. Craig Thompson, a veteran correspondent, who has worked for 20 years at home and abroad for U.S. newspapers. Day after day from now on, the first-hand reports of Craig Thompson and his staff will pour into Time's home offices.
And their Times editors will fit them together with dozens of other reports from Time correspondents and Time bureau heads all over the world. Sift and weigh these reports, check and recheck them, and then write them into Time as one straight, clear, connected story of history in the making. This is the sort of teamwork which, week after week, brings you the kind of clear, forthright news report you can find only in Time, the weekly news magazine. To some Americans, it may come as a surprise that all good Japs are not dead ones. In China tonight, there are hundreds of free Japanese working for the Chinese. These Japs are trying to get their former comrades to quit fighting. Known as the Japanese People's Emancipation League, this strange group came to light in a book just published by Henry Holt & Company, Report from Red China by Harrison Foreman, an explorer and correspondent who spent 15 years in the Far East. Made up of deserters and prisoners, won over to the Chinese, these Japs distribute handbills, pamphlets, and newspapers to the very doorsteps of Japanese blockhouses and strong points in China. In some instances, they go right up within megaphone range of a Japanese blockhouse. This is how it works. At a Japanese blockhouse in the Taihang area, the commander is summoned to the ramparts by a strange voice.
Sergeant Suzuki! Sergeant Suzuki!
This is Sergeant Suzuki. Hi!
This is Kamada! I am from your own hometown. I was in your platoon at Chongqing.
Kamada? It is impossible. Kamada is dead, tortured by the Chinese bandits.
No, no, Suzuki. The Chinese nursed me back to health. They give me the best of treatments and better food than you get, Suzuki. You should come over and join the Japanese People's Emancipation League.
Eh? What is that?
We want to stop this war that nobody wants and from which nobody will gain anything. We want peace and a people's government at home.
Why should I believe you, Kamada? We are winning everywhere.
Everywhere? Remember how you and I studied geography, Suzuki. Remember the names of places. Japan is losing everywhere.
Kamada, I want to know more of this Emancipation League.
But an even better method used by the good Japs to demoralize Japs fighting Chinese is telephone tapping. Contact may be established with a whole network of strong points. One Kobayashi set up a telephone set on New Year's Eve, then waited in the dark for a helper to cut into the Jap phone system. Then Kobayashi cranked his set.
Hello? Hello?
Is this Corporal Katayama?
Aye. Who is this?
I just called to wish you a happy new year.
Thank you. No, it isn't a happy one, is it? These North China winters are cold. By the way, is this headquarters?
No, this is Kobayashi, a member of the Japanese People's Emancipation League. Hello? Are you there?
Aye, but I do not wish to talk to you.
Tell me, how did you like the gift bags we sent you for New Year's?
Did you send them?
Yes. What is the matter?
Our lieutenant was wild when he heard about them. He said they were poison. We made some Chinese taste them first. But you know, I am not supposed to talk to you.
But Katayama, this is New Year's Eve, and you and I are homesick for our loved ones at home.
And when shall we ever see them again?
When all of you come over to our side and join the Japanese People's Emancipation League. Then we will stop this war and go home.
But they tell us you are traitors.
Katayama, when I was wounded, I wanted to commit suicide as the only honorable thing I could do. But I was wounded too badly. The Chinese saved my life, even offered me my freedom. But then I began to realize what they were fighting for.
Shh! Don't... Someone is coming. I'll have to ring off. But call me again, Kobayashi, and tell me more about this Japanese People's Emancipation League.
The members of the Japanese People's Emancipation League are few in number, but that number is growing by leaps and bounds, and many of them in the course of their frontline propaganda work have been killed by their own people. But their program is ambitious, writes Harrison Foreman. It urges Japanese soldiers to demand an immediate end of the war, to overthrow and punish the militarists and to establish a democracy in Japan. Of the emperor's fate, says League Director Susumu Okano,
"The emperor is still too much of a godlike figure to a good many Japanese for us to shout, 'Down with the emperor' at this moment. But the militarists are forcing the emperor to shoulder full responsibility for the war. When the war is lost, he must bear the blame. Japan would be much better without an emperor, as in America."
Time marches on. After 3 years of Pacific War, Americans are used to reports of Japanese soldiers committing suicide at the moment of defeat. It was not until very recently that similar incidents began to happen among German soldiers. Last week, many millions here at home saw a set of photographs taken on the Western Front of American soldiers treacherously struck down by the hand grenade of a German who had just surrendered. Tonight at the March of Time's New York microphone is the man who took those photographs. He is George Silk, New Zealand-born combat photographer for Life magazine. For the story behind those photographs, here is George Silk.
I was with some American troops approaching the German town of Jülich. Under a smoke screen, combat engineers had thrown footbridges across the Ruhr, a small but swift river. At dawn, several battalions of infantry tried to cross, but were held off by heavy fire from about 60 Germans dug in about 40 yards from one bridge. This prevented the use of this bridge until other American units crossed the river at another point and gave them covering fire. Then the combat engineers went to work to repair and strengthen this bridge. The Germans had seemed to withdraw, but now they began firing at the men in the bridge again. This time, six or eight combat engineers simply got mad and charged across 40 yards of flat terrain right into the German positions. I went along with them, hoping to get some pictures. Most of the Germans were willing to surrender because they were cut off from retreat by flooded fields behind them. About a dozen surrendered at once, and the combat engineers yelled back for reinforcements. Other engineers joined them, and soon most of the Germans in those positions had surrendered and were on their way back to the bridges. I started walking back with two engineers and four German prisoners. Three more engineers joined us to help search the prisoners. One of the Germans suddenly plunged his hands in his pockets as if to bring out weapons for surrender. His right hand came out with a live grenade. I will never forget that horrible frozen moment. An engineer next to me made a grab for the grenade, and just then it went off. It tore him to shreds. The German fell over backward, dead too. Of the remaining German prisoners in that group, two were killed and one wounded. Shrapnel also killed another American and wounded three. I got a piece in my right leg. At the sound of the explosion, other American engineers ran up. One of them recognized his closest friend amongst the dead men and kept saying in a horrified tone, "My God, he isn't dead, is he? He isn't dead." Other Americans were practically weeping with rage and hatred at the treachery that had just killed their comrades. I'm afraid there will be more of these incidents as the Germans are driven to the wall, and none of us can count on real peace in Europe until that kind of fanaticism is absolutely wiped out.
Thank you, George Silk. Biggest home front problem confronting the U.S. is post-war jobs. Primarily up to U.S. business enterprise and government to solve, it affects every U.S. civilian worker and his dependents. After victory, how many jobs will there be? Can we avoid peacetime unemployment? The goal was set during last fall's election campaign by candidate Franklin D. Roosevelt.
To assure the full realization of the right to a useful and remunerative employment, an adequate program must provide America with close to 60 million jobs.
Jobs for all. 60 million jobs became the battle cry of incoming Secretary of Commerce Henry A. Wallace. Few days ago, the slogan was taken up by Fred M. Vinson, new federal loan administrator. Said he,
"When peace comes, I will make every effort to see that the resources of our lending agencies are made available to assist American business in the task of attaining the president's goal of 60 million jobs.
60 million jobs. Well, why not? The first question, can U.S. government and industry provide 60 million jobs? Predicts the American Federation of Labor.
Private business, 52 million. Federal, state, and local government employees, 5 million. Armed services, 2.5 million. Temporarily unemployed, 1 million. Total, 60.5 million.
Agrees Beardsley Rummel of pay-as-you-go fame.
It is reasonable to expect that American private business will provide 54 to 56 million jobs after the war. Government and military services will add enough jobs to attain the goal of 60 million.
Question number two. Even if government and industry somehow manage to provide 60 million jobs, will there be 60 million available workers ready and able to fill the jobs? When youngsters go back to school, when women go back to their home fires, and elders to their firesides, will there be 60 million workers left? This week, Hearst columnist Westbrook Pegler cried with alarm.
We come to a point of finding 60 million employed workers among a total of no more than 80 million men and women. The Roosevelt-Wallace plan appears to hold that henceforth, as many women as men shall be job holders, a proportion which obviously threatens the home and the birth rate.
This week, to leading spokesman for government and labor, the March of Time posed this question.
Will there be 60 million workers?
Replied the Congress of Industrial Organizations.
We are not interested in statistical quibbles as to the exact number of jobs necessary for full employment, but only that no American should be deprived of the right to earn a decent living.
But the name most closely linked to the 60 million job slogan is that of Henry Wallace. Today, to the March of Time, said Mr. Wallace,
after the war, there will be 100 million Americans in the productive ages, of whom approximately 60 million will want employment. Except for normal governmental functions, these job opportunities should be provided by and through private enterprise. However, government must assume responsibility for assuring business expansion and development so that future periods of prosperity do not again end in depressions. Sharing responsibility by business and government licked the production problem in the war. It can do the same in peace.
Whether 60 million jobs is only a slogan, or whether it will be a post-war reality, is any man's guess. But if the U.S. accepts the theory of government responsibility for keeping the economy running at capacity, America will cross a great divide. And whether the attempt succeeds or fails, the landscape will be very different. If it means an AAA for every industry, if it means direct governmental control over every businessman and worker, then full employment will be at worst a kind of totalitarianism. But if government responsibility means stabilization of high business volume without dictating how men shall earn their livings, it will be a capitalistic blessing. Time marches on.
The March of Time on the air calls your attention to the latest March of Time on the screen. Memo from Britain. The story of how the British people are planning and working to rebuild their nation after 5 years of war and sacrifice. Watch for the newest March of Time on the screen. Memo from Britain.
Over this same network every afternoon at 4 o'clock Eastern Wartime, listen to another program prepared by the editors and correspondents of Time magazine. Time views the news. And next Thursday evening at the same time, listen again to the March of Time.
This is the Blue Network of the American Broadcasting Company.